A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
Hi everyone, I'm Andrew Kitley. Please join me for brand new episodes on my podcast, The Invisible Gift, the show about turning neurodiversity into possibility. Last week on the show, I met entrepreneur and founder of Full Spectrum, Andre Skeppel. In the episode, Andre explained the exciting mission behind his company. We also discussed the problem with education and why it's difficult to push through change when working with the government. It's a great episode, so have a listen to that show if you haven't already. On today's podcast, I'm joined by one of Australia's most highly regarded workspace designers, Domino Risch, to discuss the neurodivergent workspace. In this episode, we discuss what exactly this workspace is. Domino opens up about how she became interested in neurodiversity, and we discuss the future of working and why the past 2 years have accelerated it. But first, let's learn more about Domino in her own words.
Can you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yeah, of course. So my name's Domino. I'm a workplace designer from Sydney in Australia, and I work for an Australian architectural and design practice called Hassell. And I am Hassell's commercial and workplace sector leader. So I look after our workplace conversations globally, which is great because there's not much going on in the world of work at the moment. That's sarcasm.
Of course. What made you get into, I take it, did you take a normal step of how you got into this? Was you an architect first, or how did you get into it? How did you start your journey?
I'm one of those really unusual people that I've learned in life are unusual and I thought were completely normal or most of my life, that I had an idea that I wanted to be a designer when I was a little kid. I used to spend hours with grid paper drawing houses that were, you know, 40 rooms wide and 60 rooms long and had massive kidney-shaped swimming pools with tile hatching, and I really loved that. And funny, true story, when I was in grade six, I was 11, and we did an assignment on what you want to be when you grow up. I'm sure everybody's done one. And I told my, this was in 1987, which I don't think was that long ago, and I had a lady teacher and I said to her that I wanted to be an architect, and she said, well, you can't. And I said, why? And she said, well, for a start, you're not good enough at maths, which, fair call, she was right, but I don't think that actually mattered. And then she said, because you're a girl as well. which in hindsight possibly wasn't something that should have been said, but and it's funny how, you know, a throwaway line like that changes the course of a life. So I turned the page in the careers manual book, and the next profession was being an interior designer. And so my assignment was being an interior designer, and literally that is why I'm an interior designer now. And I'm lucky because I was happy to do that. I started working in the career and it was what I thought it was. And so here I am still, as many people would probably have taken many more twists and turns than I did, but mine's really straightforward, linear process.
So you obviously do a lot of things in the neurodiversity workspace, which is a big conversation I've been having a lot recently. Obviously, being a structural engineer and dealing with new builds and offices and stuff like that, it's something that I'm really interested in. So what made you get interested in the neurodiversity workspace?
Well, that's a longer, slightly more tortuous conversation, I suppose, or a pathway. I'm a mum of two kids, a wonderful girl who's now 14 and a little boy who's almost 10. And from the age of about four, my daughter had some terrible meltdowns and tantrums and seemed to have a few difficulties in a few areas. And we went to a child psychologist, essentially, who took one look at her and said, no, she's fine. She's got some anxiety issues. But actually, we need to work on your skills as parents. So how about we book the two of you in for recurring meetings, you know, every fortnight for several years and, you know, give us thousands of dollars and basically just leave us your credit card and that will fix things. Again, these throwaway lines seem to follow me around. And we thought to ourselves, no, that doesn't sound right. And we should have kept going at the time and kept on looking for help that actually fitted what we were trying or what we thought was wrong until we found somebody that would help. But we didn't. We struggled by ourselves for another 6 years until the behaviours at home, the kind of personality traits, the the behaviour at school and the challenges that we were facing as a family unit because of all of that just became too much. It was utterly overwhelming. And we'd done some reading about autism and ASD. I started keeping a diary so that I could try and discern patterns and triggers. Wow. To days-long meltdowns. We thought we had found a few ideas that might work, and we went back to our GP, our family doctor, and said, we really need you to help us find somebody who will help here. And we were lucky enough to be then sent to a completely different person, a pediatric doctor specializing in diagnosing behavioral disorders. And 5 months later, after being on a waiting list, which nearly broke us at that point because we felt we'd waited 6 years was long enough and another 5 months was quite horrible, we finally got to see a wonderful lady called Dr. Zalan, who sort of took one look at us, saw us every week for 1 hour over a month period. And at the end of it, we walked out of her practice with a diagnosis of what we would call Asperger's now. High functioning, and with lots of sensory and emotional kind of issues. And what happened to me at that point was that in all the reading that we were then able to do in terms of setting up our family life and my daughter and all of us really for success, in terms of sensory issues, communication issues, food issues, and there's a whole lot I could talk about food issues. And also sensory issues, I started to realize as I was reading that all of these characteristics that we were now much more aware of in our family life were things that I was seeing on a daily basis in my professional and work life. And so I started to kind of draw the link and think, well, if I can learn how to set her up for success, maybe I can bring some of that knowledge that I'm developing here into my professional life. And I realized that, you know, in every consultant meeting where you've got a project manager and an electrical engineer and a creative person and a kind of a minute taker who just wants to, you know, tick the boxes and get stuff done, that we were seeing this spectrum of human behavior and emotional intelligence. And if we could find a way to work through, you know, communication as project teams, maybe there was also something that I could do that would be of benefit to my work practice, which was to bring a sense of designing for diverse sensory experiences and tolerances into my work as a workplace designer. So that's kind of that's the long version of the story about my interest in neurodiversity.
Well, and what a story it is. So would you say that the awareness you got from your daughter, did that change how you perceived some of your colleagues that you thought actually might have very similar issues? Did it change how you dealt with them?
It did. It probably gave me a lot more of a sense of compassion for some of the behavior traits and reactions that previously were sort of unexplainable to me because I was only coming at it from my own, you know, what I think is neurotypical, which is, you know, how I think and react and behave. And I started to realize that, you know, all around me, whether there's diagnosable conditions or not, we're all on a spectrum, and that's a very overused line. But in this case, what I started to see was, you know, you just have to think about it as a slider. You know, some people are over at this end, some people are closer to that end. Some people are really triggered by, you know, maybe it's noise, maybe it's the tone of voice in a meeting, maybe it's the way the meeting's being conducted. Like if it's being led by somebody who's all fluffy and leaves things open, that's maybe going to trigger somebody who's looking for a lot more structure. And a lot more, you know, kind of ticking the box deliverable kind of activities. And I also realized that, you know, as much as I, you know, maybe I'm unique in this, but perhaps not, I prefer dealing with people who are like me because I understand them and how they tick. You know, it becomes a little bit easier when you can accommodate multiple viewpoints and, you know, not only look at things through your own lens, but start to stand in somebody else's shoes and realize that, you know, they may not be trying to make your life hard. They may be having a hard life and trying to understand where they fit in it, regardless of, again, like I say, whether they're on the spectrum or not, or diagnosed or not.
Well, it's either at a similar situation, especially around ADHD, and particularly in women, the general markers or signs of ADHD have always been mapped to boys, and particularly young boys. So for years, there's some things around. I work with half my team's female, and there were some. Now I've become much more educated on ADHD and how it sits, particularly with women. It's actually so shocking that I, as an employer, didn't notice them before. But there's just not enough awareness, and I suppose this is the whole point about finding out these sort of things and educating yourself. But this is all so new. When I talk to experts in the industry, it's all so new. Like, most of the conversations I have on this podcast come back to mental health, because obviously with all these issues comes massive mental health, not just for the people that have a lot of these problems, it's the people who are in relationships. Like I'm becoming more and more aware that I should probably have more respect for my wife putting up with me now than ever before. And I think the funny thing is, she now says, oh, I just thought you were nuts. I didn't realize that nearly everything could be attributed to your ADHD.
And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because the more we become aware as a society, and I think we're better at catching kids earlier now, and the stigmatism of saying, well, you know, I don't want an autistic child, therefore I'm not going to get a diagnosis because it's a lifelong sentence. I think I'm coming from is that kind of attitude is receding, and the idea that actually it's okay to ask for help. It's not actually a disability. I think, you know, we've got to kind of shift the conversation on that. It's actually a different set of actually quite extraordinary abilities. I'm sure you talk about, you know, the gifts that they have and the deficits that people with ASD have are remarkable and often lead to really remarkable outcomes. And, you know, maybe we can get to that with where my daughter's, the path that she's currently on. And if you had have asked me at six when we were, you know, in the middle of our most kind of desperate times without help and without an idea of what was going wrong, you know, to think of where we are now and where we were then is quite an enormous shift. And I think because of the more willingness to go down that path now with our children and having more and more of them, we're actually, and it's happened in almost every family that I've spoken to who've had a child that's been diagnosed, it's becoming so common that one or either or both of the parents perhaps could have or should have also been diagnosed as children, but it just wasn't anywhere near as common or acceptable back then. And it does start, there's a book that I have, it's A Complete Guide to Asperger's Syndrome, Tony Atwood. It's a great book. We've both as parents read it cover to cover. And there's a chapter in there at the end about what happens when your kid's diagnosed and you think you might be too, you know, what happens to you as, you know, your relationship as parents. And I do remember sitting on the couch one evening reading that going, oh, there's a whole lot of stuff here that makes some sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing. We kind of think stuff's normal until we find out about it and we're like, oh, actually, it does. In a way, a lot of people ask me the same question. Does it help having a diagnosis? And I actually think it does. I've been very careful in the way I go about saying things, because I try and always talk about the positive sides of everything. That's just me in life. I always think as much as there are negatives, there tend to be positives. But it's been really interesting learning how much of my life has been affected by it, predominantly my ADHD, not actually my dyslexia. And but I wouldn't have, I didn't know them until this is so new. Like this podcast is, it's like, oh my God, that's a trait of that, is it? Well, yeah, that's why I do it. A lot of people say to me, oh, you seem to be doing all right, but I still have my struggles. I am trying to focus on one thing is hard. I mean, I'm, as of last month, currently up to 10 businesses now, and it's really hard. And the reason why, I've got people in every business that are doing great work, but I need to be involved in everyone. And unfortunately, the shiniest one pulls my attention quickest. And it's really hard to manage that, and probably doing the worst thing ever for someone with ADHD. But then you could argue I probably couldn't have 10 businesses if I didn't have it. So it's a bit hard. But also something you've said there that's really important is I've changed the way I talk about a lot of things with neurodiversity as well. Is I used to be just positive, positive, positive. And every time I spoke to someone, I was like, no, it's all positive. But now, after really engaging with the listeners, I've realized that actually sometimes when you're in it, there are no positives at the time. You can be really in a hell state, and it's irritating when people say there's loads of positives, because it doesn't always feel that way. So I think I've probably changed my tune to more of it's a journey now, but there's not always going to be a downside. There will be brighter days. So it's really speaking to people more and more. I've actually avoided autism a lot in this podcast, because sometimes I feel that if I don't know enough about something, I shouldn't talk about it. So we are definitely getting more people to do with autism on the show now, not just people with autism, I think experts in it. So I'm gonna have a look into that book. So before we get into my really really exciting bit about the workspace, because I love a fit out, something that I try to raise awareness around, again, not just with neurodiversity, just in life generally, the one thing I say, the key to happiness is self-awareness, like knowing yourself and actually accepting who you are is, and or changing things you're not happy with, which you can, is definitely, but most people fail quite heavily in the self-awareness. They're normally very good at other people, awareness of other people, but not themselves.
Or maybe so, criticism rather than awareness.
Criticism, yeah, yeah, yeah.
A little bit of difference there.
Yeah, we are British and very cynical. So for you, would you say self-awareness is something quite important?
I think so. But one of the challenges, I think, for autistic people is being able to step outside their own experience, and even more so from neurotypical people, I think, for them to be able to understand what a neurotypical person thinks and feels is precisely their challenge. That's precisely my daughter's deficit. I don't know that she would ever be great, although we're working on it, of, you know, what's that person thinking and feeling? Or how do you think the way you have just dealt with a situation, how's that impacted on them? I mean, that's kind of, it has to be taught for autistic people. Whereas, you know, it should come a lot easier to neurotypical people, but often doesn't, again, depending on self-awareness. But I think one of the things that we have worked quite hard on is helping her understand what she's really good at, and then things that she needs to work on. And we're on a program now, you know, almost 4 full years after diagnosis. She still talks to her counselor every 2 weeks, and that works really well for kind of just explaining what are the day-to-day situations, you know, what does your swim coach say about that, what are your friends at school talking about, you know, what's happening in all of the different aspects of your life, and even down to things like drawing diagrams of friend networks, like who's best friends with who now, and what's going on in that circle, and who's the dominant person, who's the leader in that group, and helping her start to kind of map out in a much more, I suppose, both graphic but also analytical way what's going on with all of these different power groups that you know inevitably end up in all of our lives in the different realms. And helping her understand motivations, reactions, techniques, appropriate ways of behaving, appropriate language sometimes, all of those sorts of things. And that awareness is the only way we can actually move forward. Otherwise, we'd be stuck in full meltdown every second day, tantrums that last for 8 hours kind of mode. But the other thing that's happened is an awareness not only of behavior and emotion and, you know, those sorts of soft characteristics, but as I alluded to before, being able to control other elements, like, for example, and I cannot stress how important this is, regular sleep patterns, like literally to the, not necessarily timed to the minute, but you can't be going to bed at 10 o'clock one night and 8 o'clock another night and 7:30 the other night and waking up at 10 o'clock and having a sleep in or getting up at 6 in the morning. My daughter's a swimmer. She's actually an elite athlete. Her immersion in the water and almost the sensory deprivation is, for her, it's gold. We call it water therapy. And she's now, you know, on a pathway. She wants to represent Australia at 2028 Olympics. Good luck to her, I say. If that's where she goes, that's where she goes. That's her that's her safe place. And it's funny because when you swim, you can't, no one can talk to you underwater, which is great. Yeah. She's not into team sport at all. But that sensory, the immersion in the water, the sleep, the regular sleep patterns, and then the final thing is the food. And the we found before diagnosis, in my diary keeping, we found that there was a correlation between absolutely falling off the ledge in terms of extraordinary meltdowns. There was a correlation with having dairy and milk products. So we decided on our own to take dairy out of the diet, and literally within a 24-hour period, we noticed a dialing back of the intensity of the trauma and the meltdown. And so we've lived now with moving to plant-based milk, and my daughter drinks almond milk, my son drinks oat milk, and my husband drinks, I don't know, soy milk or something. You know, there's four different types of milk for four different types of people in the house now, which is fine. We're also extremely sensitive to sugar, almost cannot handle any processed food or any high, you know, cake, brownies, biscuits, can't happen because, the you know, some kids react to red food colouring. Well, you know, any bit of sugar in her world tends to send her right off the deep edge. And she's learned how to regulate her own, I'll call them eating habits. She also doesn't have a hungry sense. So one of the things that we realized is that we have to not only regulate her sleep, we have to regulate her food intake. So we literally, we have a program of consistent meals for breakfast, a consistent lunch, and a consistent two or three dinners. And that is all that's ever tried. There's, you know, we don't introduce new food. We don't deal with slimy green vegetables. We deal with, you know, things that sensorily and from a texture perspective work. And so we found that with that level of regulation together with, you know, working on emotional and behavior, we are sailing in, you know, clear, calm water. Whereas when you, you know, when everything's in a jumble and there's no routine, there's no dependability and everything's random all the time, it's complete meltdown for all people in the family, by the way, not just her.
Well, do you know what? What's really amazing, by the way, that sounds incredible. You've touched on two points that I think are really important in life, sleep and diet. What one thing that's jumped out is the first person you saw gave you and your husband stick. And ironically, you are probably the most I've just been blown away by that. That's like, that's unbelievable. So screw them.
Exactly. I'm going to carry a grudge for decades on that one, because literally we lost so many years because of that one comment, that one person. Yeah. I think also what happened was because we were so desperate for help and sort of, you know, struggling as a kind of a family to have a happy life, me turning to my more analytical side of trying to figure out what are the patterns, what are the, you know, and I literally kept a kind of a diary. What did we eat today? What were the foods that we, what were the, you know, I was trying to find patterns, and it was taking that diary in our first meeting with Dr. Zalan, and I said, okay, so these are things I've noticed. For example, she calls figures of authority. For example, I think her coach, Brett, she would call the Brett guy. And I said to the therapist, what's that about? And she said, well, that's a distancing mechanism. That's something that she's doing to try and build a wall between her and an authority figure to try and get some emotional distance. So that's what that behavior is about. And there were things like, you know, for example, you know, the food, there were particular obsessions over the years that have shifted slowly, but, you know, we were able to say, look, what is that about? And, you know, this she met my daughter first, and then the second week she just wanted to talk to us while, you know, the kids went and did something else. And I remember her saying to us, I've kind of got all I need here. You know, it was almost, she just ticked the box on the form and said, here's the form and go get your help now. So it was amazing.
But
if we hadn't have found her, I don't know who we would have found. And that's the barrier to entry, I suppose, is it's a bit of a lottery as to who you speak to and whether you find that they've got sympathy for your particular, you know, circumstance or not.
Yeah. I suppose the thing is, there's a saying, you don't know what you don't know, right? And that's the problem. You you go to these things. I actually say this about accountants as well. Everyone, you go to lawyers and architects, every profession, everyone where you're paying for their opinion and advice.
You don't know what you're going to get at the end. You don't know if they're any good.
So even us in our fields, perfect example. Yeah.
Correct.
I think Domino's openness when discussing the challenges she felt as a parent who wasn't being provided with the tools to support her child is really touching, and something a lot of people can relate to. Despite neurodiversity being something that affects so many, there is still not enough people that are familiar with it. So unfortunately, I think Domino's story is something a lot of people can relate to.
Hi everyone, I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Coming up in the podcast, Domino explains the history behind conventional workspace design and why it is designed that way. We also discuss why a one-size-fits-all method is wrong for workspaces. But before that, let's jump into what a neurodivergent workspace is and how Domino came across the concept.
Let's move on to the workspace stuff, right? So
yeah.
Can you give me a run through of some of the ideas that you've come up with or anything you want to talk about? Because this is where we could get really into it.
Well, so I like to talk about diversity being, I suppose in a corporate sense, which is I do commercial workplaces for typically large organizations, and they're usually dealing with an element of cultural change or, you know, brand alignment or something or another. And, you know, starting to become aware that there was invisible diversity as well as the, externally visible diversity of race and gender and, familial background and all of that sort of stuff. And thinking about how in some ways we have a very monotone set of tools that we use in creating working environments. So we've got desks and open plan. We've probably got meeting rooms. We've probably got, you know, open spaces where people can make a cup of tea and sit and have a chat with each other. And maybe we've got a quiet room or something. But they're usually, where there's a desk, there's 1,000 desks and they're all the same desk. You know, they might be set up in slightly different sized clusters, or they might be, you know, oriented slightly differently, but they've probably all got the same color scheme or a similar version, you know. And I started to think about, well, you know, the different sensory experiences that my daughter enjoys. So being in the water, being outside, acoustic impact for other people. She enjoys listening with headphones in. She doesn't enjoy music. Just floating around. And I know other people really can only concentrate when they've got very loud music and the kind of the regular background noise in an office of, you know, people walking and talking, phones ringing, you know, clatter of everyday life going on. That's more distracting than really loud noise. So I started thinking, okay, what if there was a strategy where in a workplace, instead of say you had 10 floors of an office, and on those 10 floors there were, you know, two quiet rooms on each floor. So what if you've got 20 rooms? What if you did 20 different versions of a quiet room? Like what if you did one that was like an anechoic chamber, which is, you know, full of like the recording studio egg crate foam, and you could go in there and listen to your Metallica or your death metal at, you know, 80 decibels, and that's what helped get you through your day, and that's what helped get you in a kind of a sense of flow so that you were really producing great thinking. Or what if you're completely different? What if that room on another floor was kind of like a terrarium, and you sat there in a kind of a semi-jungle environment and there were butterflies floating around, and that's what got you where you needed to be. What if one of them was outside and actually it was better for you because you were sitting in sunshine and you had fresh air moving and you had the wind on your face? What if there was a version that was, I don't know, shag pile carpet, and you took your shoes and socks off and you lay around rolling around on the floor with your feet up in the air? I don't know. I don't have all the answers necessarily, but what I was realizing was that this monotonous sort of one size fits all, but maybe you change the color of the walls kind of scenario of diversity in space wasn't really doing any justice to people who have diverse sensory needs. And then if you think about that, like, you can think about the kind of the different sensory experiences you can set up for different types of spaces. But then you can start to bring in the other senses. So we're working with an organization who has designed a scent, and that scent is designed in all of their locations around Australia. They're a co-working organization to feel familiar when you walk in, and a sense of connection via a sensor, you know, the olfactory sense that gives you comfort, I suppose, and confirmation that you might be in a different city, but you're in the same organization's care when you go there. And acoustics is an enormous one, as I was saying. You know, some people concentrate very well in an open plan environment, some people can't concentrate whatsoever. And so thinking about our typical kind of, you know, floors and ceilings in offices, workstations that are more open than enclosed. And now with COVID and the the rise of hybrid working, which had always been there, just meaning you could work at work, you could work from home on your kitchen table, or you know, work while you're sitting in the park or on the ferry for anyone cares, that idea of creating, giving people the choice to structure their day and their working environment in ways that suit them best, and withholding judgment about where people are most productive, is something that's really come to the fore in the last 2 years. Because many people, while they've had to work from home, and it's this giant global enforced experiment on, you know, working from home, or as I've often said, it's actually not working from home, it's living at work, except that work moved into my apartment with the rest of my family. Now I can't get it out. So, you know, understanding what works at home, I've developed over the last 2 years, because I do still spend a lot of time working from home, and my husband is often here during the day with our kids. I've developed somewhat of an ability to tune out what they're talking about, because we're all live in a, you know, we have an open plan apartment. It's not like, it's not huge. So I don't have a study. So we share the same space. And while I'm on my Zoom calls all day, I've got my headphones in, and I've learned to block that background noise out. And my challenge is to turn that skill off when the headphones come off, and actually listen, and actually participate in the conversations, and not drift off into my own mental space. So it's almost like I've created a virtual quiet room for myself when I'm sitting here in this location where I am now, in sort of in my living room. And, you know, that different sensory experiences have affected people different ways, and I can actually be more productive at home than I now can be at work, unless I go and take myself off into a little quiet zone. So it's been a big year, a couple of years, for realizing, you know, all of the things that I call them silver linings that COVID has brought us unintentionally.
That's amazing. First of all, I've got socks on here. So,
right, excellent. Well, you can have the shag pile room where you rub your feet on the floor.
Everyone in the office takes their shoes off, and it all started with me, and they all criticized me, and I was like, now everyone does it as soon as they walk in. They get to the desk, take their shoes off, and then walk around. Do you know what? It's really funny, because nearly all the stuff you've said, I've said on previous podcasts about this, but I always feel like every day I come into work anyway, I feel different. So a different work environment. And I love working outside. If you've got an environment where you work outside, but I've noticed you've got a plant in the background. I've got really funny with plants. I need plants everywhere now. And I was telling everyone, so on the wall we've got over there, which is nothing at the moment, I'm getting a moss wall put up.
Excellent.
Because love moss walls. Absolutely love them. And I feel exactly the same. I'm like, you've got to change. And I think if you come in, and you're right, so what's really funny is also different jobs attract people with different things. Most people do, like 100%. my CAD technicians love loud music. They love scruffy dressing, right? They're generally all in hoodies and stuff like that, right? So if I could lock them in a messy room where they could just chill out, recline all day, they would be in their element. Yet my engineers need, when they're doing their calculations, they need silence and stuff like that. But in between when they're doing that, they love the engagement and the collaboration space. So I really get it. I mean, for me, Connor will attest to this, that when we go to the recording studios, the sound deadening panels is just unreal. It's my happy place because it's
love
so
it, do
quiet.
Because there are some people who completely freak out at the absolute lack of noise. I know I feel slightly uncomfortable in the lack of noise. It really affects me.
So funny enough, I started this conversation a long time ago, and I'll tell you why it was. It was actually enough. I read a book about introverts and extroverts.
Susan Cain's book, Quiet.
Well, yes, that is the book that changed my view on workspace.
It's up here somewhere. I've got it. Yep.
Yes. Right. It was amazing. And I said, isn't it funny that definitely an open plan office was an idea of an extrovert?
It was. You see, work has often been considered a platform for performance, you know, and it really suits the extroverts, particularly contemporary open plan, you know, where everybody's on display all the time. We have these enormous big atriums, if you're lucky enough, for, you know, where there's lots of, we talk about it in workplace, it really helps visual connectivity. It helps teams feel like they're interconnected, and it breaks down silos, and you get the serendipitous connections of people bumping into each other on staircases. But the flip side is, if you don't like being on display, if you aren't a kind of a work extrovert, and it's possible to be a work extrovert and a home introvert, that's me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy to put on my extrovert hat when I need to, but I'm more than happy with my own quiet time at home. My husband and I rarely talk to each other at night because, you know, we've run out of words during the day, and I've become the introvert. And so workplaces have for such a long time been influenced by the performance of work. And I think one of the things that I've realized, and COVID has accelerated this, we've got a research team that does global workplace surveys. And what we have found is the number one thing that will impact somebody's decision to go and work from work as opposed to work from home if they have a choice, which thankfully most people do most of the time, is whether or not they feel like they're going to have a space that will be productive for them. And that's going to be defined as something very different depending on who you are, whether you're the introvert or the extrovert, whether you like quiet or whether you like the energy of other people being around you and the sort of, you know, the dynamic flow of ideas. The idea of there is one way to be productive, and it's this one that designers have been building for, you know, 25 years, the same way, just with a different coat of paint, is wrong. And I think we're starting to figure that out. So this is where COVID and the neurodiversity side have kind of collided in the last 2 years and allowed us to have a much better conversation about well-being in a much more holistic way in workplace, where it's not one size fits all. It never has been one size fits all. And the Taylorist model that was established in the 1900s, where, you know, everyone sits in big factory floor-like locations, they're all sitting at desks, and you've got managers that look and observe at what's going on, and that's the only way they can feel like they're doing their job. That model has almost entirely evaporated in practice overnight, but there's still many people who are holding on to it culturally and from a leadership style perspective who cannot let go. And that's the big argument in workplace at the moment is, how can I make sure my team's productive if I can't see them? I'm like, you'll figure it out when they don't answer your email. You know, it doesn't matter where they're sitting.
Yeah. I always find people who say things like that, I was like, how bad have you got to be at measuring the output of your staff if you can't, if you don't know what they're doing?
Just non-performance. You can't hide non-performance unless you're some kind of genius that I haven't come across yet. You know, if you're not doing your work, you're not doing your work. If you're falling behind, you're falling behind. It doesn't. You're measuring productivity in quanta of time and location is stupid. So I think we're really at a cusp of the, and this is slightly controversial, but the 9-to-5 Monday to Friday model that we're all kind of somehow imagined has been here for millennia and will never change is broken. I don't think it's actually making anyone happy. That's why we're seeing 4-day weeks being trialed. That's why we're seeing hybrid work is the dominant mode of work in knowledge workers all around the world. And I don't think it's going anywhere. And in fact, what we think will happen is for people who want to, work happens anywhere, anytime, anywhere. And that freedom, choice, autonomy to be able to set yourself up to work in places. Like if I want to go to the cafe and work because I actually can retreat there because I don't have my team talking to me, I'm very happy. Or if I want to work in the garden or if I want to do my Zoom calls while I'm walking around the park, why shouldn't I be able to do that? So, you know, that's a conversation that should have happened a long time ago, was always going to happen, but actually COVID has accelerated it and fast-forwarded us to a much more potential for a more human-centered way of working, which is kind of where the fourth industrial era was always going. Yeah. So that's, I think we're in it now for most of the Western knowledge working world.
Yeah. And I'll tell you one little story, which everyone always finds funny about bosses measuring their work. First company I ever worked at, there was most of the people in the company at the time smoked. So they used to all go out to the smoking areas at breaks. And I remember we had a meeting and our boss was moaning about how many cigarette breaks everyone was taking. And he said, at the very least, you could all be like Steve, who paces up and down the whole time he's smoking. He's clearly stressed and overworked, which shows that he's thinking about work while he's in his cigarette break. And I was like, what?
That's a cracker. I had a boss who said, even though office hours are from 8:30 in the morning to 5:30 at night, I want you all at your desks at 8:15 because I know you're going to spend at least 15 minutes slacking off during the day, so you owe me. That was a cracker.
Do you know what I get really – the only time I get angry at my team is if they work past their hours. I hate it. I'm like – and the reason why I do is because I worked so many late nights in my jobs and for no gain whatsoever. I don't ever want them to experience that because you end up resenting your job.
Well, you do. You do. But also there's got to be an understanding that, you know, and this comes back to, you know, how people think, how they learn, how they create. You know, I work in a – we're a design practice where there is a lot of creative people, and trying to fit creative people in a 9-to-5 Monday to Friday box and say, now go sit there and be creative in this particular hour leading up to this particular deadline so that you can present to that particular meeting is also not necessarily sensible. So, you know, I agree with you in that extended work hours are a kind of a, you know, everyone's working longer and harder and is more stressed ever than before. But part of that is, you know, kind of there's this weird expectation that if you do that, you'll get to the bottom of the to-do list. You'll never get to the bottom of the to-do list, not ever. But that shouldn't stop people being able to choose to work. Like if that might, when we were at uni, did you ever do your best uni work during daylight hours? No, you did it in, you did it late at night. You pulled all-nighters, you know, something landed. And, you know, so the idea of society kind of building rules around when you're creative or when you're productive or when is the best time to do a particular activity is also not particularly sensitive. But it's a hard conversation, isn't it?
Yeah. So my most productive hours is I get on the train quite early. I get on the train and on my train there's a desk. I sit there and it takes me 50 minutes between my train station and getting into London. And I do nearly all my day's work in that 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I've never really understood if people are really productive but half free, their brain stops working. What's the point of them sitting there for 2 hours not doing anything? Like, because we all have that cutoff point. My wife, when we first met, it used to really bother me. I was a morning person, like, really early, always have been. She's a night owl. Her brain didn't start functioning properly till 7 at night. And then she went into this like unbelievable frenzy. Overdrive. Yeah.
Yep.
And
yep.
She was amazing between that and 2 in the morning. And it's like, we just say everyone's got to sit in the same sort of level.
Yep. Which is why it's kind of a relief to now be in an environment where we can start to talk about outcome-based work or measuring contribution via contribution as opposed to presence, because presence and measuring 8-hour days and simply measuring by time isn't particularly good for people who don't fit into that box, which is many more people than you would imagine.
But we've got to talk about, if we're talking about office environment, we've also got to talk about the kind of financial benefit of it. I think what a lot of people think is, and a lot of business owners at very high levels, like corporate companies, still think, well, we're putting all this money into these workspaces, but what are we getting out? But the whole point I think we need to make is the fact that if people are happier in their work lives, they're more productive, therefore more money for the business, right?
Absolutely. There's an absolutely very clear and direct link between mental health issues in your workforce and bottom dollar productivity measures and profit measures. So the triple bottom line sort of coming together in a human-centered way. I mean, there's no way you can expect people to perform at their best if they're unwell, if they're unhappy, and if they're in a space that doesn't support them, and I mean that culturally and physically as well. And I have started to develop a theory that what I think is going on with things that we're seeing around the world, like, for example, Castle, which is an American swipe card data collection point. They've got I think it's called the Castle Index. And in the States at the moment, the average in most of their cities is about 43% of pre-COVID numbers going to work on an average day, whereas, you know, the NFL's at 86%, you know, the TSA checkpoints at airports are at, you know, 84%, so almost pre-pandemic levels. In Melbourne, which is one of our big cities here in Australia, foot traffic in the CBD is at 43% of pre-pandemic numbers, whereas we got 100,000 people at the cricket watching India play Bangladesh, just, you know, literally a street away from the CBD. And so people are coming out. It's not that the CBD is a problem. It's something's changed at work. Something's changed about people's, I think the power balance has shifted between employees and employers. I think this sense of freedom and autonomy that has happened because of COVID once lockdowns were lifted is something that's not going to go away. And I think one of the big barriers for people wanting to come back to work is a sense of mental health safety by avoiding conflict when they're at work, and cultures that aren't working well, that haven't been fixed and have probably got worse through COVID through neglect and lack of work on fixing poor behavior or challenging leadership styles that are toxic. And when you're on Zoom and maybe you can avoid talking to that person who really upsets you, and particularly for autistic people, people on the spectrum, this is going to happen a lot more than it used to, because you can simply choose not to engage with them. You know, if you're not working directly with them, but there's a certain person who just triggers you because of something they wear or even the perfume that they put on, it's actually safer psychologically to stay working from home. It might not have anything to do with COVID or physical safety, although that's still certainly a consideration for many people. But I think we have to, thinking about workplace, we actually have to fix cultures in organizations first. We have to train our leaders and our managers to work in a hybrid fashion and to accept that hybrid first is the only real way to progress. So digital work streams, always having Teams or Zoom or whatever connections, as well as face-to-face for meetings for people to choose to either be present or dial in remotely, and not be judgmental about those choices, and to allow people, you know, the ability to make those choices by themselves. I think it's a bit of a gift, to be honest.
We have obviously spoken a lot about corporate companies, and, you know, they have bigger budgets, much bigger buildings and stuff like that. How do you think smaller companies can pivot to try and create a different workspace in a smaller area?
It's a really interesting one because, you know, there's a school of thought that talks about the fact that in coming together, we need to have a bit more of a closer look at what the purpose is of doing so. So when we're choosing to work synchronously, so same time, same place, what is it that we really want to get out of that day, that hour, whatever period of time that is? Is it collaborating or is it working on my own? Because many people have taken the view that, look, if I'm just doing my inbox management, or if I've got 1,000 calls with people overseas or in different cities, I'm better off doing that at home because A, I'm not going to be disturbed. B, I don't lose my time commuting. C, I save money because I can eat what's in the fridge rather than buying my lunch. You know, all that kind of stuff. So there's that sense of prioritization. But what we do need to come to work to do that's really better face-to-face is collaboration, innovation, you know, all of those sorts of things that are much harder to do online, still possible, but better face-to-face, and building relationships is certainly part of that. So when you think about what does that mean for an office, like the day is coming, and it's literally only months away. We're about to start working on one now where we actually have a deskless office. There's no workstations. And the only thing that will be in the office are things that support collaborative and social engagement. So it'll be a giant, you know, like in a home, the kitchen is the heart, and after the dinner party, you all end up in the kitchen. There will be that kind of space where people congregate in areas where there's hospitality, there's food and beverage, there's places they can sit and chat, and that it's not ergonomic furniture. You know, I think that's the big thing that we've learned, is that people aren't coming to work to spend 8 hours at a workstation staring at a spreadsheet. That's not what anybody is coming to work for. So we need to create more magnetic reasons for people to want to come to work, and it's usually around collaborating with other people and reconnecting face-to-face. And I think that probably gives us a bit of a clue as to how workplaces are going to start to transform. It's not like they're going to suddenly look like something out of Blade Runner. So, you know, I think the kind of the kid of, like, we're not talking sci-fi kind of 1,000 years into the future here. What we're talking about in terms of change of workplace is a kind of a tweaking of the dial. So much less individual workspace, still some where you need to duck away for a phone call or sit in a chair that looks out at a window and have your laptop on a little laptop table and bash away. I'd be happy. I have no need for any ergonomic furniture ever again. Even things like Zoom rooms. So having a little quiet room. Somebody asked me the other day, you know those ring lights that make you look good in your Zoom call? Installing those in meeting rooms with a non-glass door behind you, or a neutral backdrop, so that your, you know, your Zoom backdrop, if you want to look like you're in the Bahamas or your favorite castle in, you know, Switzerland, or, you know, pictures of your dogs or whatever it might be on your Zoom background, can be easily done, like your wall. You got a ring light. There you go. So we're talking about, you're looking good, by the way. That's excellent. So, you know, we're talking about doing stuff like that, which isn't, you know, we've never really had to do that before, but the Zoom call and spaces for people to be able to work like that, as opposed to workstation, double monitors, sitting there by myself but with other people, that's the kind of thing that's going to disappear a little bit, and it'll either be more team-based work, so everyone sitting at a kitchen table type of scenario, working away if that's what they choose, or retreat space where people can get disconnection, which is just as important as getting connection. So I think we're going to see spaces that support the more outer edges of the work experience, rather than the big lump and middle, which is what most of our open plan, whether they're large or small workspaces, have been like to date. We're kind of only at the beginning of the changes that we are going to see because of COVID to workplace and the very nature of work itself. And one of the things that we know for sure is going to happen, particularly as there's a bit of an economic crunch globally that's kind of upon us, if not already here, is that most workplaces are now larger than they need to be for the amount of people that turn up every day. Now, if you're in, I think in the UK, you guys call it agile working, so where there's not a desk for everybody, and, you know, people might come in and choose the right place to sit for them, or they've got a neighbourhood where their team always tends to congregate so they can find the people they're working with. If you're already in that kind of environment where there's a ratio of desks to people, it's kind of easy to reduce your footprint, because you start to say, okay, well, look, our average turn up on a week might be 50% of our headcount. So we're just going to give back floors or close down parts of our tenancy so that we can get that buzz. But when you're a multi-story, like you've got 20 floors in a skyrise or in a tower in a city, that's a lot harder. So we have just started working with an organisation who's got a landlord who's building a building specifically for them, where they've got 15 floors, and we've worked to get a kind of a really dense cluster at the bottom of those 15 floors, which has got all of the big meeting rooms, all the cafe spaces, big town halls and steps like you're talking about, where you can gather and without being in a meeting room. And then, you know, some of the more dedicated functions, like, you know, big comms rooms, and, you know, all the things that you need to run a really big workplace. And then the kind of the 10 floors above them are all exactly identical, although there's color and texture and sensory differences, but in terms of functionality, they're all exactly the same and the floor plan is exactly the same. And what they're going to do is they're working with a tech provider who's designed an app that uses machine learning where you feed in when you're there and who you're working with, and it trawls your, this is slightly scary, it trawls your email and figures out who you work with, who you contact, who you tend to communicate with most often, who you're calling on your Teams calls, and it draws all that data together and it forces you, it tells you where you're going to be working. So on a Monday, for example, when you know only 30% of your people are there, it crunches the floors that are open for use down to the two floors so that you get a real buzz. And what happens is the building then turns the air conditioning, the lighting, there's no cleaners that night on all of the other eight floors that then haven't been used. And you're going to save an absolute fortune, even if you're still paying rent on that floor. The outgoings and the benefit to the environment from not using all of that energy is going to be enormous. But on Wednesday, which is peak going to work day everywhere in the world, all floors will be open, but you'll still be drawn to the right place so that you can be with the teams that you're on. So we're starting to call this the elastic workspace, where we're going to use AI and machine learning and technology to drive better experiences for varying levels of presence during the week. I mean, it's kind of exciting.
That is insanely exciting. Yeah. Oh my God. That is amazing. I love that.
Now, that's going to be kind of hard to do if you're a small organization with like 40 people. But one of the things I heard the other day is that, you know, we have co-working providers. You've got lots of them. Fora in London are a group that we work with all the time. You know, when you go and buy a membership and you have a desk for a day or a suite for your people to work in. Mm. We have a client who is a co-working provider, and they were asked by a small business of about 200 people to provide them with a working zone. But they said in a COVID world, we're actually only expecting 90 of them to turn up at any one point in time. So we've already got less than half our people there. But then they said on top of that, of those 90 people that will turn up on a regular day, we only want 30 things that look like desks, because we expect two-thirds of those people to be coming to work to kind of connect with each other, to collaborate. And so we've got 30 desks for 200 people. Now, as a kind of a sharing ratio, I think that's, my brain can't even compare. I'm not a maths person. But, you know, that's kind of extreme. So you can see, even on a small scale, if you start to look really closely at purpose and why people are coming to work, and then start to adapt your space and the settings that are in the space to actually support those activities as opposed to what you think they'll be doing, then you can actually make a real difference, and you can probably give back space that you don't need as a result.
Amazing. So increased productivity and cheaper workspaces. I love it.
It's coming. And that means cheaper workspace, more tenants, more project work, more structural engineering for you, more workplace design for me. It's all fantastic.
It sounds like a great deal. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been amazing.
It's been really great to talk to you too.
Well, that's the end of the podcast today. Thank you so much, Domino, for sharing your time with us. Neurodivergent workspace is a fascinating subject, and I'm really excited to see how we can implement the ideas you talked about going forward. If you want to learn more about Domino, you can find her on LinkedIn, or you can visit the Hassle Studio website. Next week on the podcast, I sit down with fellow podcaster and custodian of Beaver Castle, Emma, the Duchess of Rutland. In the episode, the Duchess explains her own struggles with education and how it made her fearless in the face of failure. The Duchess and I also discussed whether her entrepreneurial brain comes from her dyslexia and why neurodivergents can be such great visionaries. Make sure you tune in next week to hear this episode. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. First off, make sure to subscribe to The Invisible Gift wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically be notified about new episodes. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kazra is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, Maisie, Jordan and Kate, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.